Welcome to the Lovejoy House, sponsored by Cook, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love my tap. I really do. I really, really do love my tap. Out of one tap, I have chilled filtered water. I have chilled sparkling filtered water. I have normal, a mixture of the water off the mains, which I assume it comes off the mains, which is cold and warm, or, you know, like hot to do the washing up. And I also have 100-degree boiling hot water. It's magic. I'm telling you, it's magic. I love my tap. I really do. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. I love my podcast also. I really do. Please, if you can be asking me some feedback on these podcasts, tell me what you like. You can tell me what you don't like if you want, but go easy. I'm a delicate soul. I've got very thin skin. I don't like criticism. I like when people are nice to me. I like people being nice. Lovejoyhour@gmail.com is my email address if you would like to speak to me. Today, I'm speaking to the QI elves. We're going to talk about their jobs, how it all works, how they know their facts are real. They've got a new book out, Funny You Should Ask Again. More of your questions answered by the QI elves. I mean, it is just great podcast this, because we just get through so many subjects with so many different facts. Just a nice little jolly through. Talk about ghosts, obviously, because I'm obsessed with that, and aliens and conspiracy theories and all those sorts of things. And also some interesting real facts too. Let's meet them. Here's a couple of the elves. Here is James Harkin and Andrew Hunter Murray. Andrew, James, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me today. How are you both?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Tim.
I thought what we'd do is we'd start with a fact. I love your book, by the way, because it's one of those books, as you know, that when you start, like all your books, you just can't stop, can you? Because you just, it's just nice. Like, just, we love a bit of knowledge, and I'll get into that in a minute. But first of all, let's start with a fact. Why do we never get tinned broccoli? Who wants to take that?
I can, ooh, I suppose. Basically, because it doesn't really survive the tinning process very well. You can get it. It is possible, but it just tastes disgusting. It just gets all stodgy. And yeah, it's just not very nice if you try and do it.
And that's because you have to boil it to make sure it...
yeah, of course. And if you've ever boiled broccoli for more than maybe about 2 or 3 minutes, it just turns into an absolute mush.
Okay.
Well, happy memories of school days there.
Yeah.
It's really, really bringing back the sense of memory, the Madeleine moment of that broccoli. And the fact about tinning the other day. Sorry, can I just derail us? It was initially not tins, it was glass bottles that things were cooked in and then preserved in, and, you know, sterilized and sealed and all of that. Glass was the way to do it. I think it was a guy called Nicholas Appert who had the first factory, but he was providing the military with rations. And so he initially provided things like a whole sheep in a massive jar. That is a vague memory, but I'm
wow,
sure.
Like Damien Hirst kind of thing,
yeah,
right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, Damien Hirst just stole that off him, yeah, didn't he?
I suppose the classic tinning fact is the fact that the tin opener was invented quite a lot after the tin. Yes. So for the first like 30 years or so, you had to open it with a chisel.
Wow. That is interesting. And also the other day I saw on the internet that when you use your tin opener, we're all using it wrong. We're doing it the wrong way around. You're supposed to take the whole of the top off. Like, so it cuts, rather than cuts in the top, you cut around the side.
Oh,
that is actually how you're supposed to open a tin, apparently. But I'm not I believe that.
I've got one of those, you know, those like battery tin openers where you just put it on and it opens it itself. And I think that might be the best thing that I've ever bought in my entire life.
Does that open it? Does that cut it at the top? Or does that cut it around the side?
The whole, around the side, I think, actually. Yeah,
exactly. All right, who's going to take this? Andrew, tell us what spam email, was spam emailed named after the tinned meat?
Oh, this is taxing me. I don't think it was.
James, do you know? Because apparently it was. So
yeah.
Oh, there we go.
It kind of was. The idea was it came from the Monty Python sketch, didn't it? So the Monty Python sketch where they go spam, 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 spam with this, spam with that, spam with the other. And so it kind of came a thing that you were annoyed because you got so much of it all the time.
Right, brilliant. Mm. Right, tell us about the elves then. How many elves are there at the moment, and what do you all do? How does it all work?
It's a very uncertain number, the number of elves. It sort of mushrooms and then shrinks as the year goes on, because it's seasonal work, QI. It's like farming, basically. So there's a small crew who do the whole year round, and then when we need to grow the facts for the next series of QI and then harvest them, the company mushrooms to this massive size, and then, yeah, it shrinks back down
after
that.
Do you think you've squeezed everything out of that metaphor?
I'm trying to think of something about scythes or combine harvesters, and I'm getting nothing. at the moment, how many are there, James? About 12? 15?
Yeah, about 12, because we've just started working on the next season of QI, which will be the T season, because each season is about different letters of the alphabet. And so we've just started in the last couple of weeks, and that means that we're in our big mushroom time with about a dozen of us.
And how does it work? Are you very competitive with each other to try and get the best facts?
Yes, it's a basics, I reckon. Do you remember, Andy, there was a time we were in a cafe with a friend of ours, Levin Skyra, who's a Belgian kind of science communicator. And we were just chatting with him, and he told us this fact that the highest point of the Alps is actually in a museum, I think in Belgium or the Netherlands or something like that. And what had happened is someone had cut the top off the mountain, taken it down and put it in a museum. And we all loved that fact so much. It was literally a race back to the office to try and get it into our forums. Do you know that movie? Is it called It's a Mad, 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 Mad yes. World or whatever? It was a bit like that. We were all just racing home.
Yeah, it's true. There is competition. Sometimes we, because we're on T at the moment, so many letters begin with T. So if you want to plow your own furrow, hey, I found another thing for the farming metaphor. Brilliant. If you want to do that, you can just say, right, I'm going to research tortoises or troglodytes or Tuvalu or whatever it is. And you can be assured if you pick something really obscure, you won't have too many other people trying to find stuff on the same thing.
You could go with the word the. Because then you can go, oh, look at all the bands beginning with the, or something like that. Are you like Tory MPs? Do you all have...
I don't know where this is going.
Are we all corrupt? What?
Yeah, do you have second jobs that...
Oh, I see.
You're doing as well as your elves. Because Andrew, you work at Private Eye, don't you?
I do. I do one day a week at Private Eye, and then I'm at QI the other 4 days a week. Yeah.
You also have Ostentatious that you do.
That's true. I'm in a Jane Austen themed improvised comedy group, which is obviously my real passion in life. And the other two things are just kind of passing the time in between Ostentatious.
You're also a novelist as well, don't forget.
Well, there is that. But I think that, oh dear, I'm feeling increasingly like the most highly jobbed Tory. I didn't think I was going to be compared to a Tory MP today. This has ruined the whole afternoon.
You've got so many farms.
Is all your money, does it all go offshore as well?
Ostentatious is based in the Cayman Islands for solid reasons. We do a lot of shows there.
Let's get on to Ostentatious, because I love this. Because in America, I listen to a lot of American podcasts. And they're always banging on about improv, because all the comedians have to go. They have to cut their teeth in these improv classes, and then they end up on Saturday Night Live or writing for The Simpsons or something like that, as Conan O'Brien always talks about and things like that. Over here, improv doesn't seem to be as prolific. Why not?
I don't know. I think it's not seen as being a proper thing. Which is a shame, because, well, I think improv is a proper thing, but it's not recognized as being improv. So every panel show you see on TV, and in fact, the podcast we do, No Such Thing as a Fish, we come with some facts that we've researched, but the conversation is completely spontaneous. We don't know what the others are going to say. The whole success or failure of the show rests on those moments of improvisation, finding joy, finding a joke, playing with the joke with each other, building it up layer by layer. So I think improv is huge here, but it's just not called improv. If you see what I mean.
Yeah. I suppose that's the panel show, isn't it? But how many of your shows are, I know they're all completely different because you're improvising, but how many start looking similar-ish? Is there a similar vein which runs through most of them?
I mean, we've done about, yeah.
There isn't really. I mean, there are a few like jokes that we kind of say all the time. Like we always like to spoil the end of Anna Karenina, the novel by Tolstoy. That is about as highbrow in joke as you can get, I reckon. But we kind of go into lots of things. We like to look at funny animals. We like to look at people with funny names, that kind of thing. So you do get a few themes like that. But we have the whole world to look at on our show. We can look at absolutely anything in the world. So you're never going to get short of things, I reckon.
Yeah. On Ostentatious, how often is that running same? No, but that's a good answer, but I'm just intrigued about improv.
Well, Ostentatious has been going since about 2011, and they're all based on Jane Austen novels, so there have been quite a lot of marriages at the end of the show. That is kind of...
How many novels did Jane Austen write?
Oh, 794. You know, very exciting. Not the six, we think. And so, yeah, there definitely is a kind of Austen-y... We're in the world of Austen, so some things are going to crop up, and one of those is going to be a romantic plot of some kind. But it does get pretty freaky along the way, so
yeah.
We'll try and mix it up.
James, what is the success to the podcast then? Is it, I listen to a lot of podcasts, far too many podcasts, and one of the things that I've heard quite a lot is that humans for survival are obsessed with knowledge. Is that the success to the podcast? Do you think that is what it is?
We'd like to think that it was something as highbrow as that, but I think there is something in it for sure. I think people are really curious, aren't they? Just naturally want to learn facts. And when you learn something, you always kind of want to spread it to the next person. You always, as soon as you hear an amazing fact, you just want to go and tell someone else what it is. It's a bit like a joke in that way, I reckon. So if you get a really funny joke, you just want to go and tell someone. If you're the same with the facts. And actually they're kind of created the same way as well. So with a joke, you have a setup, it goes in one direction, and at the end it just flips. But it has to be something that you're quite familiar with at the start. And we think that's kind of the same with facts. It's got to be something which you're kind of familiar with. It needs to be about doors, it needs to be about coats, it needs to be about, you know, soccer balls or whatever. It needs to be something that everyone's familiar with. And then at the end there's a little switcheroo that makes you go, wow, that's an interesting fact, I need to tell someone.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm.
But do you think there's certain subjects that we're more intrigued by? I mean, I'd say looking at the Mail Online, anyone who that's the most successful website, isn't it? They love cancer, don't they? They love medicine on there. They love discussing medicine. Actually, in fairness, my daughter and all her classmates, as soon as Adam Kay's book came out. They all got obsessed with that because it was about medicine and about the body. And I wondered whether that was that same thing, that survival technique kicking in. I'm overthinking everything, but
I think that's a really good point. One of the first facts that we ever had, maybe the first facts on the podcast, was that for the last few months of his life, the president, James Garfield, ate everything through his anus.
Just for pleasure?
Well, it's related to it being the last months of his life because he'd been shot and he had to be lying on his front. The medicine was very poor at the time. They couldn't find the bullet or extract it. And so to feed him, he had to have everything through his bottom. And he had a rich range of meals served to him. You know, it was definitely eggs at some point, and I think possibly some stew.
I remember that his favorite food was squirrel soup.
Oh,
yeah. We could never work out whether he got some squirrel soup up his anus or not. We could never find that out.
What's the point? You can't taste it. You can put anything up there, can you?
I think you get a tiny proportion of the nutrition you'd otherwise get. That was certainly the thing. That was what they were banking
on. No, but I do see your point, Tim. It's like there's not much point putting some seasoning on it, is it?
Hang on. We have covered that. You've definitely got taste buds, for example, in your testicles. Do you remember we mentioned that you've got taste buds in your testicles, and I can't remember what the purpose is, but there are taste buds all the way through the body in unexpected places.
What's interesting about taste is Heston Blumenthal came on Soccer M when I was presenting that, and he got me to do this experiment where you put a very strong flavored sweet in my mouth, but got me to hold my nose, and I couldn't taste it. Then he said, "Let go of your nose," and suddenly the flavor—it was an apple pie or something—but it came through, and it was absolutely amazing. I've seen now they've invented this water bottle. It's called some Air Go or something. It's called. Or Air Up or something. Anyway, it's a water bottle, and around the bit where you drink from, you slide on this little round capsule which puts in the smell of orange or lemon. And as you drink, because you're smelling orange or lemon, you're only drinking water, but you believe you are drinking the orange juice or lemon juice, whatever it is, the flavor. And apparently it works. And people keep saying online that it's an amazing thing. And I wonder if that's going to change, that potentially could change the way we consume calories in the future. You know, you could just eat tofu, but have it taste of roast beef.
Oh, that's a great idea.
As you smell it, and then you can keep your calorie count down as long as you're getting the smells in. Guys, are you in? How much do you want to put into my meal?
Okay, here's the thing, Tim. I once read that if you eat a raw onion, and you hold your nose, it'll taste like an apple. Yeah. And I tried it out, and at least for me, it doesn't work. It just tastes like an onion. And also, I read that if you put some raw onion in your shoes and you walk around the town all day, by the end of the day, you'll be tasting the onion. That didn't work for me either. Okay. And at the same time, I read that if you never wash your hair for about 3 or 4 months, then it will start washing itself. Yeah. And again, for me, that didn't really work either. But I was walking around London smelling of hair and onions for quite a long period.
It was definitely your sort of strange hermit in the wilderness phase of QI. Did you try the testicle thing, James? Did you pack your raw onion around your testicles and see if you could taste those?
I didn't do that, but maybe that's for next year. Tea for testicles for QI. And we can get Alan Davis to do it on the show, maybe.
Yeah, perfect.
You need a hypnotist to make the apple taste like the onion to taste like an apple. But he also makes your seat really hot as well, so be careful. I was on your website just having a look around, just to, you know, like I do because I'm a pro doing a bit of research, and I went onto your message board. Oh my god, you got some know-it-alls there, haven't you? This is the only problem with coming up with facts is you will get people who will believe that they know more. And what I loved was people on the message board. So this is obviously a long time ago because they were talking about Stephen. Can you point out to Stephen that he's not pronouncing it correctly? Jesus Christ. You must attract a lot of those people.
Yeah, we do. We don't mind it so much, actually, because a lot of, even when we do the live shows, the No Such Thing as a Fish live shows, the heckles that we get are usually like the world expert in that field. You know, we'll be talking about Daddy Long Legs and someone will say, actually, that is pronounced like this. And it's like, okay, well, if you're an expert, fair enough. We had a guy on QI once. We put a picture of what we thought was a Rolls-Royce engine on the screens, and someone wrote to us saying that can't be a Rolls-Royce engine. I might get this wrong again, but it was something like Rolls-Royce engines always go around clockwise and that engine was going around anti-clockwise. And what had happened was we'd taken the video and it just somehow got accidentally flipped from the computer to going onto the screen. So it was the right thing. But this person wrote in and they said in their email, they said, as thanks for pointing this out, I would like a signed photograph of Stephen Fry. I do not mind who signs the photograph as long as it is of Stephen Fry.
The problem with social media now is if you've got a little in joke, like I always call Viscount Biscuits Viscount, and I did it the other day on the show just for a laugh. I don't know why. It's like I used to say, rather than Warsaw on Soccer M, I used to say Warsaw. But in the good old days, people used to email in like if they could be asked. But now there's social media. I mean, this whole thing started a few Sundays ago. Lovejoy's pronouncing it Viscount. Like, he must be feeling so stupid. He's going to lose a load of sleep. It's like, oh Christ, you know, it's kind of insane, isn't it? How that works. Yeah. I seem to remember on Record Breakers years ago, and I might have made this up, but I seem to remember that a little kid sat down with what was his name, Norris McWhirter, and said, "What's the biggest diamond in the world?" And Norris McWhirter said, "It's the so-and-so." And the kid went, "No, you're wrong."
Oh, no.
That was the beginning of the end.
And he said, "It's somebody else." I seem to remember that happening. Now, that I could have made that up. I think Record Breakers might have been live because a lot of TV was live years ago. And I think that could have happened, or it might be one of those hypocritical tales. So talking about hypocritical tales, how do you know whether a fact is real or not? How much checking are you doing on the facts?
Oh, nightmare. Well, we really try, and there's lots of checking that goes on. I mean, the dream is that you have at least two independent and first-hand sources for the fact that you're talking about. But sometimes, you know, that gold standard isn't available because we're researching really obscure things or something. There's only been one study of this particular phenomenon. So James, you might remember this. A few years ago, I wrote to that scientist in Botswana who'd been painting He'd been painting eyes on the bottoms of his cows.
I do remember that. Yeah, yeah.
And he was doing it so that lions wouldn't attack the cows, because when the lions approached the cows, they'd see this huge pair of eyes looking back at them and think, "Oh, that cow's facing me. I won't attack it." Now that has only been studied once, this phenomenon, and so you can definitely report the findings and say, well, it seems to deter lions from attacking cows, but you can't, there hasn't been a study of 50,000 cows across the world in different countries. So,
but we think that Andy emailing the one person who does it is probably quite a good source, right? And the other thing is, like you were saying about how competitive we are, all the elves, I think we're always trying to prove each other's facts wrong. And there's about a dozen of the most pedantic people that you've ever met in your life. And so when you've done your facts and you've got your sources, if those other 11 people haven't managed to prove it wrong, then fingers crossed, you know, we're going to make a few mistakes. Everyone makes a few mistakes, but we know also, at least when we make the mistakes, we can always give people points back in later series, or,
it's like science then. You're like scientists, because that's what they do, don't they? They put up a theory, then they wait for everybody else to prove it's wrong.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
I think we're often in awe of scientists, aren't we, really? Because when we're just people who are finding all the work that the scientists have done and then telling it to the world, we don't do any of the work. We just kind of take the work and then pass it on. We're kind of middlemen in that.
How often do you come across stuff which is bullshit, but it's been put out there and people are saying, you know, this is fact? How often is that?
There's not a lot of out and out completely made up stuff out there, unless it's a brilliant hoax. Lots of times,
but there's a lot of people hoaxing, isn't there? I mean, I want to get onto some of my things that I'm interested in a minute, but there's a lot of people. I mean, my brother's dead now, sadly, but he used to like making stuff up he was like kind of really weirdly intelligent, but he used to go around telling people when microwaves came along, he said, but the food keeps cooking once it's in your body and it poaches your kidneys, so don't eat it. But the amount of people he told, because he used to hang around in lots of pubs, and so that I'm sure there's people out there. They're going, don't eat microwave food because it keeps cooking once you've eaten it. It's not hard to get that fact online now and spread it.
Yeah, there was a lot of worry about microwaves, wasn't there, when they first came out? And there had to be, in America, they had to get, like, I think the government had to put out films to say, no, honestly, you're not going to get radiation poisoning from these microwaves.
Oh, really?
But a few times we've kind of fallen foul on QI, haven't we? Do you remember we said something was in one of the early Olympics? Can you remember what it was?
Dog grooming.
Dog grooming,
in the 1900 Olympics or the 1896 Olympics or something, yeah.
And that happened to be an April Fool's trick from, I think, The Guardian or The Independent or something like that. And the thing is with the internet is the idea of April Fool's tricks and back in the day was you would do it on April Fool's Day. It would be in the morning, couldn't be in the afternoon. And then by the time midday comes, you go, aha, April Fool, you've kind of been caught. But now, of course, the April Fool story is always on the internet. It's there forever. And how often do you read an article on the internet and check what date it says in the top corner?
Mm. It's funny, actually. We had Daisy May Cooper on Sunday brunch the other day, and she was bored and so decided to invent a load of ghosts around where she lived. And eventually... so she's like an original hoaxer, and she sort of said there was the ghost in W.H. Smith, and there was the cleaning ghost, and you could tell it was when she was around because you could smell Mr. Sheen and all that sort of crap. But then some journalist phoned her up. I read this in her book. Some journalist phoned her up and said, can I write about these ghosts? And she was like, yeah, sure. I love this idea. So she wrote all about the ghosts. And then a year or so later, another journalist, desperate for a story, as you know, journalists are, they're always desperate for something, phoned up and repeated the whole thing again. But when it happens twice, surely then it's got some, surely it's got some gravitas then, and people start going, this is real, you know, this is something which actually happened. Yeah. Yeah. Something which happened to me when I was researching on Big Breakfast years ago was I was booking people for the show, and it turns out one of the newspapers got hold of it. There was this guy who was I actually booked him for one of my shows. I don't think it was strictly through me, but he was on one of the shows I produced or researched. I can't remember now. But this guy was going around pretending he had amazing powers for like seeing illness. So he'd done eyes, and then he'd done something else, and then he'd done tongues. But he'd just done it in disguise every time. And he's just, he was a charlatan. And then we all got called into this meeting and said, we've got to double check all these people, because, you know, it was at that time when they were going, TV has to be real now, because TV wasn't real for a little while, as we all know. And I suppose you lot are under real scrutiny with what you're doing.
What was that thing, Andy, that Dan from the podcast was saying to us yesterday about Alan's son?
Oh, he thought that one of the children in Outnumbered was the son of Alan Davis.
And the reason he thought it is because it was on Wikipedia, right?
Oh.
And it was on Wikipedia for just about an hour. And someone put it up, and then the Wikipedia people went, no, that's obviously nonsense, and took it down. Yeah. But for that 1 hour, Dan had gone on the website and read it and gone, this is brilliant. Let's get this kid on the show. He looks just like Alan, and it's going to be amazing. And yeah, it just turned out to be...
Yeah, that's nothing.
Yeah,
that's actually a huge problem, isn't it? Fake news, fake information must be something you have to sift through. I went on a TV show once. I'm not going to say which one, and they basically, I just make stuff up every now and then. I don't so much when social media came along. I thought the idea was make my life look more interesting than it was. Don't be real. So I used to be sitting watching TV, going, yeah, I'm drinking a cocktail with like a footballer or something. Just make crap up. And sadly, I went on this show, and I'd said I'd done a full body wax. I don't know why I'd said that. And one of the first questions was, you've done a full body wax, haven't you? And I was like, going, oh no, this is really bad. The researchers basically sifted through all my lies and come up. And I was sitting there going, no. And it was horrific. But yeah, as I said, all right, let's change tack slightly. What do you think stops information traveling through? Because it's so weird, don't you think, that we've lost so much information over the years? You know what I mean? When you look back at history and you go, how do we not know these things?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean like, yeah. So there are a lot of things that we once knew and we don't know anymore. Like, for instance, we know that the Romans made this amazing concrete, right? That was way harder than the concrete we have today. And we don't know what the recipe is. And we know it's there, but we don't know how to make it. We think it's something to do with volcanic rocks and the water that they have around there and stuff like that. But we don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is like the medium that it was written in, right? So these days, if it's written in a book, then books don't last forever. They'll kind of rot eventually. And then some of the things that were written in the 20th century and put on, you know, Betamax or... you know, something, we don't have a way to read them anymore.
Yeah.
We can definitely lose information that way.
And it's so recent, the stuff that can be lost by being on Betamax, which is within the last 30 years. It's not like it's, you know, an ancient Sumerian text or anything like that. It is, yeah, it's terrifying.
There was a tribe who forgot how to make fire, wasn't there? Was it the Andamanese?
Yes. And did they have to have someone carrying bit of fire at all times? It was crucial for the survival of the tribe.
Imagine that. Like, I can't even keep a barbecue going. But if you're the guy in the tribe that keeps the fire going, and then whenever it went out, they just had to wait for another lightning storm to kind of set fire, and then they would do it again.
That's amazing. Do you enjoy what you do? You seem to love the way one of you says a fact and the other one goes, yeah, I remember. Yeah, yeah. Do you enjoy it? Is this something you love doing?
Oh, how could you not? It's so much fun. I mean, it's the dream. It's, you know, I didn't think that you could be paid for doing something like this. Just reading all the time, finding out as much as you can and trying to pass it on.
I remember I was listening to your interview with Jimmy Carr the other day, Tim, and he was like, it's best when you can make your job more fun than fun, I think is what he said. And that definitely is what we have. It's 100% like, you wake up in the morning and all you have to do is try and find something funny about any subject in the world. What can be better than that?
Is it like a band though? Is it like when you sit down, you've got, I don't know, 50 facts for tea and you've got to get it down to 15 and you're all sitting there going, which ones are we going to use? Is that how it works?
It is a bit like that.
It is a bit, yeah.
It's a bit like you were saying about the American comedy and British comedy and stuff and SNL and all that kind of thing. Most British comedies, if you look at sitcoms anyway and things, then most of the great comedies were written by one or two people, right? They would kind of put themselves in a room and write it. And then when you look at things like Friends and The Simpsons, you have massive teams of people who are getting it all together. And QI is kind of way closer to the American way of doing it, which is we have a huge group of people, 12 people, and we all have equal input, and we're all kind of trying to just winnow it down to the absolute best facts and the best questions and all that kind of thing.
Does that come from John Lloyd? I've interviewed him on my podcast. I love that man.
Yeah.
It's all him, really. Yeah. We're just conduits for John Lloyd's.
It's brilliant, though, isn't it? The TV show, the books, the podcast, on the radio. I mean, it's just, people can't get enough of you guys, can they?
Well, hopefully.
They can't. They absolutely can't. We're a hot property.
What is the live show like? I've not seen you do it.
Oh, it's raucous. We have to pause in the interval to put the roof back on the building.
it's what it is, Tim, is we're trying to find, we go to all these towns. We're in York last night, for instance, and we're trying to find the nerdiest person in the whole of York. And our theory is that whoever that nerdiest person is, they probably came to our show. So we've already narrowed it down to 1,000 people. And we're just trying to find the nerdiest person in that room. And people send us their kind of nerd credentials. We had one guy the other day who said he was writing a book. He was halfway through a book about the hairdryers of Europe. And we were like, oh, wow, you're halfway through it. He's like, oh, actually, I was halfway through it, but I've realized now that it's a trilogy.
Oh, no.
Oh, you get amazing people in the audience. We had a couple of people. Well, someone tweeted at us last night from halfway through the show saying, I was expecting the audience here to be nerdy, but the people in front of me are arguing in Latin. It's very interesting fans. Yeah,
that is fantastic. Actually, it occurred to me the other day when I was reading about this guy. He was basically telling Stephen that he was using a hard G rather than a soft G on a pronunciation of something on one of the words or something. Actually, that's a weird one. I've always thought it's weird with vegan, how that is a hard G, whereas vegetarian and vegetable, it should be a vegan, really. But does it matter? No, it doesn't matter. But it occurred to me that people, like, they're obsessed with keeping the language pure. And yet, the language, if we go back 1,000 years, say, we probably wouldn't be able to understand what people were saying, would we? Because the language has evolved so much in 1,000 years. Is that true?
Yeah.
Definitely. 100% true. There's one word, isn't there, that hasn't changed since the Stone Age in English. And more like Scottish, actually, and it's the word lox, L-O-X, which is like salmon. It's like a salmon food that you can eat. And apparently, if we went back to the Stone Age and asked them for some lox, they would know exactly
what
we
want. That's great. But would they give us some schmear with it?
What?
Lox and schmear. That's a thing, isn't it? Smoked salmon and cream cheese. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, sorry. You don't get much lox in Bolton, I must admit.
Sorry, my bagel shop days are coming back to me.
That's a fantastic fact. In fact, I ended up just doing a tiny bit of what you do because I thought, how old are humans? How long have they been around? So I didn't know. And they're 300,000 years, roughly. I got that off the internet, so it could be wrong. And then I started thinking about Jesus and, BC and all that sort of stuff. And apparently Jesus was born 4 BC. So he was born even before he existed, which is amazing. Yeah. I don't know how he did that.
First miracle. Very impressive. Straight out of the gate.
And I was like, how did that work? And then I gave up.
There was an attempt to calculate it several hundred years after, 1 BC or 1 AD. And it was a monk who was called Denis Exiguus. I think he was called Denis the Small his name. It was a great name. And I think he calculated it. And then several years or decades later, it was realized, oh, no, Denis got it slightly wrong.
I think because he had to be born in the time of King Herod the Great. And we know when Herod the Great was alive. So it had to be a different time. But I think the last pope but one officially said, okay, Denis the Small was wrong. We admit it. It was 4 BC or AD or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So
yeah.
We're really not in 2021. We're in 2019.
It can't be 2017 again. 2017 was right. I just remember it was rubbish.
We just wanted to be 2020 again.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want to go through those years again, do we?
Funny our perception on the world and life, though. I've always thought about this. If you look at money perception, like I was listening to this on a podcast the other day, like if you're given £100, it's not as valuable as losing £100. People hate losing £100 more than they like giving it. It's, you know, it's ridiculous that you'll go everywhere to save a quid, yet you'll get £100,000 mortgage, which you have to pay off every month. Now, these things are perceptions. And the one which really always is stuck in my mind is the music industry, because we're born with the music industry buoyant, right? Because the people were buying records. I think the 80s or the 90s was the peak of buying records. But, you know, in the 50s, they started doing it, in the 60s and something. When you got to streaming services, Fergal Sharkey, which from The Undertones, fantastic man. But he started saying, if we don't do something about this, the music will die. And it's like, Fergal, for God's sake, man, music's been around 300,000 years since we could bang a stick against a rock. And he thinks it's going to die. It's been a really small industry. It's only just over 100 years old when people actually started to buy records, I think, when they bought the old, what were those things called, wax cylinders or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go onto vinyl and then all the, you know, CD, and that, now it's MP3 or streaming or whatever. And it's such a strange, because we've got a very strange perception, haven't we, of how things are. It's only modern history that we really are concerned about.
Yeah, yeah. James, you've got something on this about, is it landline phones?
Oh yeah, I was just thinking about before the wax cylinders, you could buy like sheet music. Do you remember that?
That's right, yeah. And as well as sheet music, you can buy some good stuff as well.
And there was one year in the 20s where Yes, We Have No Bananas was selling like 20,000 sheet musics a day or something like that. The thing on phones is basically the three of us, I think, grew up probably with a landline in our house.
Yeah.
But actually, if you think about the entire time of humanity, how much time there was when having a landline in the house was a normal thing to be. It was like literally, what, 60, 70 years, 100 years, something like that. But to us, it's just the normal, natural thing for someone to have in the house. But actually, it's just completely unusual. It's completely mad. And anyone before that time and anyone after that time will think, what were you doing having a landline in your house?
Yeah. The great thing about doing Sunday brunch is we have these great experts who come on. They impart knowledge into my head and then I forget it 5 minutes after the show. But one of them came, and I think he was talking about Charles Dickens and how Dickens became this prolific writer, where at Christmas Carol and stuff, they would write it and then they'd print it up and then everybody would try and get it. It was like having a hot record on vinyl, where there was only a limited, and everyone wanted them.
Because there was no
way of getting these out there apart from getting them quickly printed up somehow, was there?
But what was pirates. The thing, Andy? Was it Little Dorrit or something?
It was Little Dorrit. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was in America. Can you remember? I can't really remember this.
It was Little Nell. Little Nell, and the book that Little Nell is in, which I think is the old Curiosity Shop, but I might be wrong. Please don't write in. but they basically they were all serialized, like you said, Tim, and they were shipped over one by one, you know, in installments, and the story was so exciting that there were people waiting at the docks for the ship to come in saying, what happens to Little Nell? What happens to Little Nell? And that was the most thrilling thing that was happening in New York, of all places.
And I think the guy on the boat would shout out, so they didn't have to wait to read it. Yeah, yeah, it was like, spoiler, everyone!
Do you think you two have a better perspective on life because you're doing this constantly? Because obviously things like the smartphone, they're pretty new in our lives, whereas you've got that perspective constantly going, this is a pretty new thing, whereas we forget it because we're not always looking around history like you guys are.
It probably does make it... I wouldn't say we're extremely wise, but I would say that, no, I think it probably does help you zoom out and, yeah, get a tiny bit of perspective.
Well, let's say, for instance, the pandemic. We go, the pandemic, oh, this is horrific. You'll go, hold on a second, there was the Spanish flu, there was the plague, and you can probably list off five great of these pandemics which happened, or disease-ridden places where, like, hundreds of thousands of people died, or tens of thousands, you know, it's immediate. Millions, weren't there, in some of them?
I think that maybe on the podcast about 5 or 6 years ago, Anna might have said that there might be a pandemic of coronavirus in the future or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, we were talking about coronaviruses, and that's the sort of family of viruses, because they have these spikes that look like a crown, so they get called corona. And we were saying that they were in camels, they were in bats, and you know there is a possibility of transmission to humans. We didn't buy shares in AstraZeneca or Pfizer at the time, so it was wasted knowledge, really. You know.
If ever you need perspective, you just got to look into the life of Genghis Khan and the mischief he got up to. That, I mean, you know, if you're ever feeling shit about yourself, think about him rolling into your town, because that guy was just, he just killed everything, didn't he? I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of murders that guy did. He spent the whole of his life killing people. He went all the way up to Russia, didn't he, killing people? I mean, can you imagine being in a little village in Russia and Genghis Khan, his bob come over and just kill you all.
They almost got all the way to Europe, didn't they? One thing I really like about the Genghis Khan people was that obviously they had these amazing sort of catapults and trebuchets that they used to use to fire at the cities. And so what the towns would do is, if they heard that the Mongols were on the way, they would send people out to get all the stones in the area, gather them all up and bring them into the city so that the Mongols wouldn't have anything to fire at them.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Well, I heard on Horrible Histories that Genghis Khan wouldn't let his army wash for some reason. I can't remember why now. And that's me all over, half a fact. That's what they call me, half a fact, Tim. Just before we get into, I want you to do some stuff for me on. I want aliens, I want ghosts, I want traditions, I want superstitions, all the things that I'm interested in. But Andrew, I just want to talk to you, talking about communication, private eye. Is it true that private eye's readership is going up, as in purchasing the copy of the paper?
Yeah, I think it is. I don't think sales have been this high since the 80s, the 90s. So I think that is true, yes.
Why is that? Because like everything else, the trend is down, where everything is. I was reading the other day that Ian Hislop, because you were coming on here today, I read it. Hislop's been there since 86. Oh my God, yeah. that is incredible.
He became editor at age 26. It's extraordinary. I think the thing about Private Eye is it's a fortnightly thing, which is nice for people. So it's kind of a treat that arrives. And also it's doing something that not many other papers or magazines are doing, really. So there is lots of in-depth reporting, but there are a lot of cartoons, there are a lot of jokes in the middle pages, there are the book reviews, and it feels like a club. And that's the nice thing for readers. And that, I think, is with everything you do. I think if you can get your audience to feel like they're in a club, like, it's why we have such a nice time with Fish, is because our audience are, we're a big dorky club together, and the four of us are the kind of steering committee who might be on stage, but everyone is involved in this. So I think that's part of the secret of it.
Yeah, a part of a community. I've always said that what you need to be part of a community is you need some like angles, you know, some stuff that you're interested in, but you also need an enemy. I've always thought that's an important thing, you
know? Who's the enemy of no such thing as a fish?
I don't know. Who is your enemy? When I was on Soccer M years ago, I looked at Ant and Dec doing SMTV and I was like, oh my God, they're huge. And that show was just getting bigger and bigger. So I started every week just like hammering them, just as a child. I used to speak to them about it. And people used to get involved. And then one day Chris Moyle started having a go at me. And I was like, this is even better. He's got millions listening to his radio show. It's always better to have like your enemy to have more than you. So
we need to aim for the biggest podcast. Like My Dad Wrote a Porno.
That's it.
Yeah. Shag Married Annoyed.
Yeah, I think. Oh, they're a bunch of assholes, aren't they? Chris and Rosie Ramsey. Yeah, those
guys. Great. I think you should go Joe Rogan, go America. Oh, set your targets higher. Right, what are we going to do first? Ghosts, aliens, superstitions, traditions and superstitions make me laugh, because traditions they're just kind of weird. It's like what dead people do, isn't it? We're just keeping going something dead people thought was interesting. And as we know, super traditions, and I think that probably the lifespan of a tradition is pretty small, maybe a couple of hundred years max. And yet we keep them going for some reason, and they become so important in our lives.
Yeah. Do you think like sometimes they originally were quite a useful thing? Like, I don't know. Do we have it in Britain? They have it in Russia anyway, that you should never put a pair of shoes on the table. Otherwise, someone's going to die. And obviously, you know, if you've been walking around in the mud, you don't want to put your shoes on the table. That makes sense. But then,
Simon Rimmer on my show this week said, because we had a bloke on talking about superstitions, he's written a book, and he said the reason you don't put your shoes on the table is from mining towns. Let me get this right. When miners died in the mine, they'd come and they'd put their shoes on the table and their clothes on the table, and that's what it symbolizes. apparently. How true that is, I don't know. I mean, things like, I mean, there can't be a reason to throwing a bouquet and flowers and all the bridesmaids scrapping for it, as we see on YouTube all the time, can we? I mean, that's got to be a pretty modern thing.
Oh, but I do remember a different wedding tradition, and it's from a time when there were other, you know, wedding things. And it was, you would have, instead of a wedding cake, you'd have a thing called bride pie. And it was this huge pie with pretty much a bit of everything in it. And I think there was something hidden inside it, like another ring or a trinket or that kind of thing. And whoever got that trinket in their slice of pie was going to be the one to get married next. So I think these things do change.
I remember cock's combs and lamb's testicles. Yeah. And yes. I think, you know, your trinket or your lamb's testicle, which one are you going to get?
What is that? What are you talking about? What's
that? That was the stuff in the pie. That was all the stuff in the bride pie. It was just full of, you know, yeah, as James says, testicles and bacon and tongues and, you know, horrible things.
I always think it's weird when it comes to things to do with royalty or parliament. I mentioned in my email to you the other day, Black Rod, I always find, like, when all that stuff happens, it's like, has nobody thought, this it's just like, a, you know, when he's banging on the door and all that sort of stuff. This is, it's like, these people, it just, they look like lunatics, you know? Have you seen it when they're on the border of Pakistan and India, that dance they do?
Yeah,
I mean, it's lovely, but it's like, has no one gone, hold on a second, guys, what are we doing? Really, what are we doing? This is insane.
But I suppose the alternative is that India and China, or India and Pakistan, is that the alternative is they go to war, right? So I guess, like... rather than that, you just do a silly little dance, then that's not so bad.
But I think with the royal family is they need these traditions, don't they? They need them so badly. And you see the royal correspondent saying, oh, and she's wearing the so-and-so crown this year because of the da-di-da-di-da, and there's so much meaning behind it. There's no meaning. She's putting a crown on. No one cares, really, in the great scheme of things. But the only thing I always think about the Queen was when it was Prince Harry and Meghan's wedding, my little daughter, who was probably 6 at the time or something, maybe even a bit younger, she was running around. I said, come here, look. It was me and her. And I said, look, this is the wedding. And she was looking at it. And I said, that woman there is the Queen. And the first thing she said was, where's her crown? And I do think if you want to be the Queen, you need to be wearing a crown more regularly. You know, I mean, I think
it's heavy. It's very heavy. I think some days on the tiara are also acceptable. I think,
you know. Just on the royal family, Andy, do you remember what was the one subject? We used to have a TV show, which was based on the podcast, which was No Such Thing as the News. And it was about things that was happening in the world around that time. And there was only one subject that we weren't allowed to make any jokes about. Can you remember? BBC News told us we were never allowed to make jokes about it.
It was the royal. It wasn't our royals, was it?
No, it was the Thai royal family, I think.
Really?
Apparently, they are not even litigious. It was just like, if you make jokes about the Thai royal family, you will get in so much trouble. It is really not worth it, guys.
Exactly. And they said that, you know, because they have such a cult of extreme respect and deference to their own royal family, they said that even if you're not planning to go to Thailand, there are BBC correspondents in Thailand.
Wow.
And they will get in trouble if you make a joke about the Thai royals on your show. So didn't.
If you go to a Thai restaurant over here, they've often got the picture of them up, haven't they? Thailand, they've got the picture of the royal family everywhere. When I worked on the BBC years ago, I wasn't allowed, it was maybe 15 years ago or something, I'm not sure, but I wasn't allowed to blaspheme. And because it's just, you go, oh, Jesus, every now and then your language, then you would get, you know, you'd get phoned up the next week and saying, you said Jesus on the show, it's a Sunday morning, you're not allowed to blaspheme. I'm like, what? What's this? And it's like, you know, I thought, you know, if I was swearing, then I'd get it. But I just had no idea that. I don't think it's as big now, but it was quite big back then. So I think it's all calmed down. When I interviewed Harriet Harman on this show, she said she would talk about, on this podcast, I went through the whole of her political career. And then I went, do you think we should have a monarchy? And she goes, I won't talk about it. And I went, what? And she goes, I won't talk about that. It's the one subject I've learned, never talk about the Queen. Because all publics, they love their kings and queens, don't they? They're royal family, they're monarchs. So it's one of those things that you probably can't get involved in. Right. The other subjects I was interested in were ghosts and aliens. I love this. Have you got any facts on ghosts or aliens for me?
Ooh, James, what have you got?
Well, there was that old fact that we had about in Poland, they only had one ghost hunter, and he claimed that all the ghosts had gone on strike. And the reason he hadn't found any ghosts is because everyone these days is so skeptical, the ghosts have decided they're not going to haunt anyone anymore.
Oh, that's such a good fact.
Have either of you ever seen a ghost?
No, because they don't exist, possibly.
Oh, okay. All
right. Well, okay. According to me, they don't exist. There's only one of our team who believes in ghosts, and that's Anna, isn't it? You would think not, but she does.
Right. What about aliens? Have you seen any UFOs or aliens?
I wish. Have you got selling my story around the world if I had? I think it was. Yeah, we did a fact about the head of the. It's a curveball. The head of the International Chess Federation was abducted by aliens in 1997, so he says, and they showed him around the galaxy. And he's maintained the story since then. He is called, his surname is Ilyumjinov.
Like Ilyumjinov, yeah.
Yeah. And he also claims that aliens are the aliens who brought us sweet corn in the first place. Yeah. So if you enjoy sweet corn.
Did he not say like that when he saw the aliens and they took him around the whole of the universe, the one thing they said is that everyone on Earth should play more chess?
Yes.
Give me money. Yeah. Do you ever get sort of entrenched in conspiracy theories as you're doing your research? One of the ones that I love is, have you heard of a guy called Graham Hancock? He's the guy who believes there was a superior race of people who lived here. They created the pyramids and what's under the pyramids. He's proved it, apparently. And he says there's no way that we were advanced enough to make the pyramids. But then there was a superior race of people who were on this planet and they got wiped out through... that he doesn't know. He's not saying they're aliens. He's saying they got wiped out. And then we are the result coming through afterwards. And that is why we are have things like the pyramids. Then he said, and if you look at the Amazon jungle from satellite, you can see hidden towns. And actually,
that's interesting because that is true, isn't it?
You sort of can, yeah. Yeah. And so he said that is because of all those civilizations. So I end up going down these rabbit holes all the time. Do you find yourself doing that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of part of the fun. But I think you have to take everything with a skeptical mind. And that's even something kind of quite mundane, where it's just, here's a fact about the etymology of the word pig or something, at the same time as if it's about these amazing buildings that were built in the Amazon. I think you have to all the time just be kind of being a little bit skeptical about everything. But that, I mean, I think the best conspiracy theories are the ones that have got a little bit of truth to them, right? Because if he could say, I've got this massive theory, it's all sounds absolutely crazy. For instance, here's a thing about the Amazon. And then when you go, oh, that's rubbish, he's like, no, but look, the evidence of this part of it is here. So that surely gives credence to the rest of my theory.
Because people did make massive earthworks in the Amazon, didn't they? There was lots of it, which was, you know, dug and channeled and cultivated much more than we were aware of until quite recently. But I think that is just an example of how amazing human beings are. I mean, the fact that the pyramids were produced and these huge earthworks, I mean, we've got to back ourselves. And we think of the people in the past as being, you know, idiots. And they weren't. They were very intelligent, working with what they had and working with the civilization they had so far. So I think, you know, they did do all these amazing things. And that's as amazing in a way. As in, it doesn't need to be a super race or of supreme or superior beings who did that.
They can be just as intelligent as us, but they didn't have smartphones, so they couldn't go on the internet. But what they did have was big stones, and they had ways of rolling things. And so they used exactly the same intellect as we have, but they used it in a different way to make these pyramids.
What do you think intelligence is? It's a weird thing, isn't it, intelligence? There's however many species they've been in this planet. We've all developed eyes. Well, a lot of us have. We've developed ears, things like that. But only one species has developed the intelligence to think like we are.
Like with the animals, like intelligence is usually how similar are you to humans?
Yeah,
that's kind of what.
Yeah,
I don't know. We did a fact yesterday about my fact of the show was squid don't play games. And the idea is that some animals do play games and some animals don't play games. And by games, it's something which you do just because for no particular reason. You do it again and again. It's you're not under stress when you're doing it. So octopuses will kind of chase little crabs like a cat might chase a mouse, but squid don't do it. And these are two really closely related animals. And the reason we kind of think that maybe octopuses are more intelligent, one of the reasons is because they do this kind of playing where there's no real reason for it. They just do it for fun.
Mm. I'll tell you a good fact about octopuses. We used to, Simon on Sunday brunch, he used to cook octopus quite a lot. He won't do it anymore. And we don't do it on the show anymore because there's been such a rise of, including me, I won't eat it anymore. There's been such a rise of programs showing how intelligent octopuses are, even though they've got a very short life. They're very intelligent and they apparently can recognize humans. They can open jars. They can do tricks and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm the same. I won't eat them for that same reason.
And oh, now, guys, so, same. This is great. This is the revolution beginning. I love it.
It is. So people are going, it's not acceptable to eat them anymore. It's like, it would be like eating, I don't know, horse or dog or something, which is eaten all over the world, but we won't do it anymore. And the other one we're not doing, I speak for Simon, but I'm not sure. I think he's not doing it, is rabbit. Because the last time we cooked rabbit, which was a good few years ago now, because it looks like an animal, it's sort of become unacceptable to cook animals like that on TV.
Do you mean when it's cooked?
Things have changed. No, because it's in its raw form. He goes, there's a rabbit. It looks like an animal. People are finding it very unacceptable now. So things are changing dramatically as we go. Right, let's finish it off with another couple of facts from your books. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. I feel like I'm on one of your podcasts, which is great.
I wanted to just tell you that octopuses bite the aliens.
Do you know what? That is one of the theories, isn't it? I tell you, if anyone's interested, go and look at anyone listening to this, go and look at Graham Hancock. I tell you, every time I go onto that guy's website or I start, he did a great podcast with Joe Rogan where he brings out millions of things constantly and goes, here, look at this. This cannot be from our... he believes the sun keeps on having these flare-ups. And we're only one flare up away from being ruined, the whole of the Earth, human race. It gets too hot or something and then cools down dramatically. And that's what maybe killed out the dinosaurs or whatever. And he believes there might have been a superior race, which is wiped out. And one of the reasons why we can't, I can't believe I'm now spreading the conspiracy, but one of the reasons why we can't find enough stuff on this superior race, which he thinks is intelligent,
because everything was on Betamax.
Everything very, very similar. He believes that the new race of humans, which came along afterwards, which survived basically, but maybe weren't as intelligent or something like that, they probably built the pyramids and they built all these sites up on the old site. So he says, what you've got to do is you've got to go and get all the artifacts that we love, the great buildings that we love, knock them down and dig under, then you'll find the original people.
Wow.
That's he said, but look up Graham Hancock. He's fantastic. It's well worth wasting a couple of hours on that, because if you think, I so wish that was true, we found out there was another race of people who lived here. Right, why do some, what's the one I really like? I like this one. Is it true that inside every fig there is a dead wasp?
Oh, it's not true anymore, but I think it used to be true. So figs do, in the wild, get pollinated by wasps, which crawl inside. They've been fertilized. They die in there. And then the fig grows away. But the flowers are on the inside of the fig. So it's how the fig gets pollinated, and it's how the wasp has a safe place to breed, basically. So there are now more... I think more farmed figs, which don't rely on this method anymore. And also the fig does digest the wasp. So it's very rare to open up a fig and find a dead wasp inside. Almost never happens. It's never happened to me, and I've eaten figs before. So figs, yeah.
Yeah, it says the enzymes eventually digest the wasp if it was, but you're right, yeah, they're farmed now. These facts are amazing, aren't they? I just do love this. It's a fantastic book. I've got one more here, which I really like, is why do some plants close their flowers at night? Do anyone remember why you put this one in here?
Well, I think it's to save energy, isn't it? Is that right?
Well, also their reproductive system is found.
That's right, of course. So Yeah, their reproductive system is right in the middle of the flower. So they open up their petals so that the bees and the birds can get in there. And then at nighttime, obviously, they don't need that anymore. The bees are all asleep. So what do? They close their petals.
So sweet.
Yeah, and I have you seen that thing that, what's it called? Magic, no, it's not called magic mushroom, something fungus, beautiful fungus or something. Have you seen that documentary on Netflix? It's a fantastic thing. In it, they claim that plants are actually talking to each other.
And
they use fungus like the internet. Like
the mycorrhizal network, it's called, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah. And he said they can warn each other. So they're actually in a communication. And they went as far on this documentary to say adult trees look after the baby trees and try and get water to them and stuff. And you're going, hold on a second. Well, I can't eat them either then.
No more trees on Sunday brunch, I'm afraid, Tim.
Not eating any more trees on Sunday brunch. No, no vegetables, nothing. Guys, it's been fantastic speaking to you today. Thank you so much for joining me. Funny You Should Ask Again, More of Your Questions Answered by the QI Elves is out right now. Well worth the read. Love that. What letter are we at now? T?
T, yeah. S is on TV at the moment and T will be recording in the spring.
Okay. How's Sandy getting on?
She's brilliant. Right. Yeah. She doesn't let us slack off at all, Sandy.
Oh, is she? She's a bit of a taskmaster.
She's great. Sandy, she is really hands-on when it comes to the scripts and the questions and stuff like that. We'll send her the our ideas of the questions and stuff, and she's always adding her old things and adding her own ideas and her own facts, and she's one of us, really.
She's such a great appointment, isn't she, for that job? Because Stephen was so good. Like, you thought no one's ever going to be able to replace her, and yet she's been magical, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. Fabulous. Stephen. Yeah. Stephen was the kind of person who would come in and he didn't know, or you know, he's got an amazing hinterland of knowledge, but you would give him something very obscure, and just on the day he would learn it within 20 minutes. He would suddenly become a world expert on that subject immediately. And then the way Sandy works is very much like, for the month before, she'll be coming into the meeting, she'll be giving us ideas, she'll be like, why didn't we do a question like this, why don't we do a question like that. So it's very different ways for us to work, but I agree they're both in their own way absolutely brilliant.
James, Andrew, thank you so much for joining me. I've learned so much. I'd have forgotten it all by dinner time, but thank you so much. Cheers, guys.
Thanks, Tim.